Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, the 21st of February. This hour, we are broadcasting live on the edge of Waikiki, where we'll look at issues related to climate change and rising sea levels. But first, we hear from State Attorney General Ann Lopez. We talk about the lawsuits she and other states have filed to challenge some of President Donald Trump's executive orders, which they maintain are unconstitutional. We hear from the city's chief resilience officer about how we plan for Waikiki's future. Could federal funds dry up? We head out in the field with a scientist to explore the hidden threat of underground flooding. And we check in with the city's director of environmental services. What keeps him up at night as we ponder the future of Waikiki? We could face a rise in sea levels of up to 6 feet before we know it. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, a federal court judge heard arguments over a challenge by state attorneys general, including Hawaii's own Ann Lopez. It was over a freeze of federal funds that affects everything from projects to prepare for climate change to programs to encourage diversity. After a two-hour hearing, that judge extended a temporary block of the funding freeze. We spoke with Lopez yesterday afternoon on the eve of the hearing. Hawaii joined with other Democratic attorneys general across the country in a half a dozen suits on everything from birthright immigration laws to DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency led by Elon Musk. One area where Hawaii could be hard hit is the freeze on funding for the National Institutes of Health.
The NIH provides huge amounts of funding throughout the United States for medical research, everything from Alzheimer's to cancer. And that case affected Hawaii directly. UH receives about $211 million in NIH grants. The monies that were going to be reduced would have reduced the monies that they received from 54% to 15%. So we joined that one in conjunction with UH. And then the last case we joined was what were called Doge 2. That was against Elon Musk. And in that case, we're arguing that his work is violating what is called the Appointments Clause, which basically means that certain kinds of high-level executive functions have to be done by people who have gone through Senate confirmation. And in this situation, Elon Musk has not been obviously confirmed, and yet he's taking actions that are really actions that should be only done by directors of United States departments. So we argue that all of his actions are not legal as a result of the fact that he hasn't been Senate confirmed.
So there are five right now. And
right.
Are there more coming?
I'm sure there will be, given the fact that President Trump and Elon Musk seem to be dismissive of the rule of law and the constitutional rights that Americans have. And as long as they continue to take actions that expressly violate the Constitution or violate the law and the rights that all of us have, then we will continue to either file lawsuits if we are able to or join other lawsuits if we need to.
Well, what can you say about rule of law and, you know, the fact that everything's been thrown into chaos?
It has been thrown into chaos. You're absolutely right. My position is that at this point, the way that we resolve issues when there are violations of the Constitution or violations of law is that those issues are taken to the judiciary. That is the job of judiciaries, to determine whether or not laws or actions are legal or consistent with what the law is. So with respect, for example, to the birthright citizenship case, the Democratic AGs filed two separate cases both of them for TROs, both of those TROs were granted. Those cases are now on appeal in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and in the First Circuit Court of Appeals. So I think we're going to see quickly how the judiciary starts to respond to the excesses and the abuses that the president and Elon Musk are continuing.
Well, the one challenge with the Office of Budget and Management, where they've froze the funds and then some funds were flowing, but then there are restrictions. I mean, it's everything from environmental issues. You know, there's reports that the solar rooftop programs could be affected. There are nonprofits out in the field, you know, with wildfire safety that are being stymied. What else can you share about where we're at with that?
Right now with the OMB lawsuit, we have obtained the temporary restraining order. Friday, there is a hearing on the motion for preliminary injunction. In that case, that is where these issues of their continued, not just the original freezing and the impact on organizations, state government, as well as nonprofits that receive federal funds, but also their continued disregard for the restraining order. And that's demonstrated regularly by either funds being refrozen or a ceiling of funds at $1 or turning off funds and then turning funds back on, depending on what the Democratic AGs are actually filing in the court. So we will have that hearing, and I am very hopeful that we will get an order in our favor on that. I think that the abuses are apparent, and they continue to basically say that they don't have to follow the rule of law and that the judiciary has no authority over them. So I'm very hopeful that the judge in that case will understand that a bright line has to be drawn. These are really serious constitutional issues that the court is going to be struggling with. And I imagine that because of the critical nature of the issues before the judge, that they'll take whatever time they need to make sure that they make a decision and that the decision is consistent with the rule of law. I want people to know the work that my office is doing with the other Democratic attorneys general is being done every single day with regular phone calls amongst the attorney generals as well as the staff. And as these issues come up and as new violations are discovered, then we will continue to fight against the violations of the rule of law. There are some actions the president can take legally, and those are things that we would just be spinning our wheels on if we tried to fight back on. So we're trying to operate not as the resistance to this president, but as the defenders of the rule of law. So I want people to know that we are fighting very hard. I have dedicated and passionate deputy attorneys general in my office who are working on this every single day. And the group of attorneys general, there's 23 of us. I think that we all respect each other. We understand the historic nature of the work that we're doing, and we're taking our jobs very seriously.
So you're trying to be strategic and precise and lay out the strongest arguments that you can in order to prevail.
Exactly.
For the general public, they may be a little mystified, you know, when we hear about the layoffs or the offers of the buyouts. Some might be wondering, well, what about contract law? You know, don't the unions have a labor contract in place? And how is it that, you know, they can be let go with no notice or little notice?
Well, I'll tell you, I can't speak authoritatively on that issue just because we don't represent those employees, and so I've never reviewed their collective bargaining agreements. But I am confident that their collective bargaining agreements have specific requirements for how you separate somebody from work. They have been trying to get around those agreements, I think, by firing people who are still in a probationary period for their employment, thinking that in that context, they won't have any collective bargaining rights. I would argue that's probably not true. I think that civil servants do have some rights. And so I know that those unions are fighting back and trying their best to protect their members' rights.
Well, there's just so much uncertainty. Everything is coming so fast and people aren't sure what to do or, you know, what can they do?
I think that there are a lot of great non-governmental organizations that are in this fight. and this fight to win, whether it's for reproductive rights or environmental rights. And I guess I would encourage people to get involved with those organizations and figure out how they can participate in a way that adds more force to the fight. For some, it might just be donating money. For others, it might be volunteering time. But I think that that's probably the best way forward for people who want to be active and feel like they're taking part in this fight.
You know, just from where we sit, we're having difficulty getting good numbers on, let's say, how many federal employees have taken the buyout here in Hawaii, you know, how many probationary employees might have been cut. And even our congressional delegation seems to be frustrated as well because they're not getting a clear count. What's it like from your office? Are you able to get any of that data?
With respect to the federal workers, no. We have had some good conversations with their unions, and I think that contacting the unions might be the most expeditious way to see if you can't obtain some of that information.
Good tip. Thank you for that. Well, like I said, it has been a little exasperating because the people that we do contact are afraid to talk.
You're absolutely right about that. And I have encouraged people to reach out to my office if they feel like something is happening that violates the law. But you're right, there is an extreme amount of fear amongst the federal workforce. And nonprofit organizations who obtain funding from the federal government, because there is a real and present danger that funding can be threatened and turned off. I want people to know that this is truly the fight of my generation, and I am dedicated to it. I'm passionate about it, and we will work every single day to ensure that the rights of the people of Hawaii are not trampled on.
That was State Attorney General Ann Lopez, who spoke with us about the many legal challenges that have been filed over President Donald Trump's executive orders. We are broadcasting live from the edge of Waikiki, and we'll be back with more right after a short break.
Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikapila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Dr. Billy Bergen, UH Biology Professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainane Kahaunaile. For more information, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Merriman's Restaurants and Big Island Coffee Roasters.
Support for HPR comes from UHM Kennedy Theater, presenting the rock opera Rent, an exploration of self-discovery amidst adversity, February 28th to March 9th. Tickets by searching UHM Kennedy Theater.
We are broadcasting live on the edge of Waikiki this morning. We are at the Library for the Blind and Print Disabled, which is located at the diamond-head end of the Alawai Canal. On a recent morning down at Waikiki Beach, construction crews were hard at work. Engineering workers hired by the city are demolishing a section of sidewalk at Queens Beach, which collapsed because of wave surge. The $3 million project comes just after the Waikiki Aquarium spent $1.5 million to repair its seawall. It's also just beginning a $5 million fix to deal with outfall issues that require a new injection well on property to process its aquarium wastewater. Next to the aquarium is the Waikiki War Memorial Natatorium. That project is awaiting an updated design and cost estimate to possibly restore it and reopen it to the public. The proposal is to incorporate ways to deal with rising sea levels. We talked to one beachgoer who said he learned to swim at the natatorium. He laments the wearing away of the Diamond Head end of Waikiki, where seawalls have hardened the shore and sand on the beach has disappeared.
When I raised, I live here all my life, and I work in Waikiki, and I come down to the beach as often as I can. Yeah.
And so what have you seen?
A lot of sand is going out from the tide. So now to shore it up, they built like this cement barrier. So that way it keeps it from eroding more. So I don't know, I don't know if they can control it, but they're doing whatever they can, you know.
Where we're standing, they have replaced the sidewalk, which, you know, has collapsed in the past.
Yes.
And they're continuing to do more work over here. What are your thoughts about sea level rise and what's going to happen to Waikiki?
Can't control Mother Nature, you know, that's because of the climate control. You know, the iceberg is melting, so more water, so the water got to go somewhere.
We also spoke with Matthew Brown, the managing librarian here at the Library for Blind and Print Disabled. Brown had a career in the Navy where he witnessed the consequences of sea level rise in some of the most remote island chains in the world. He's lived in Hawaii for the past 16 years and began by telling us some of the changes he's noticed in that time.
You know, just down the street here at the Queens Beach, there was a lifeguard tower that is no longer there because, of course, the sea came in and took away, eroded away all the sand, and the whole walkway has changed. And then, of course, I look at the Alawai Canal every day, and, you know, sometimes high tide, it seems really high. And I think, you know, it's only a matter of time before it's going to overtop. So I do think about that. I see that, and I wonder about it.
What do you feel needs priority in terms of addressing sea level rise? Are there ideas out there that you think have traction?
I think in this very important discussion, it's a team effort. There's probably no one thing that is the be-all, end-all answer. It's everybody working together. Not too long ago, I heard some folks talking, including there was a U.S. Pacific Command commander who said the thing he was the most worried about was climate change. And of course, the direct impact here is rising sea levels. I've had the chance to visit some other Pacific islands that are fairly low-lying. And while they may be dry under normal circumstances, it takes one tsunami, one big, you know, storm system, especially with a king tide, and those islands are overtopped. And those are people's homes. And so we have to think about this, but it's a collective solution. It's not any one thing. We all have to work together on it.
And I assume by all work together there, you're talking about sort of us as individuals and institutions, right?
Sure. It's we can all as individuals do our part, but it's also organizations. It's government at all levels. It's private organization. It's going to take everybody to you know, turn back the trend that we're seeing right now. And I think we have to do that because at the end of the day, this is people's lives. You know, initially, yes, islands being overtopped. But, you know, as time goes on and it's our climate is changing, it means our food, you know, resources are probably going to be affected, maybe air quality, all sorts of things. And so long term, really some disastrous impacts, I think, from what we're seeing, you know, with climate change, and sea level rise is just one indicator.
And you interact a lot with the public here in your role in the library. Does this topic ever come up? Is it a sort of something you hear people who visit the library talk about?
So here at Library for the Blind and Print Disabled, you know, you might think that people who are blind or low vision wouldn't be observing some of these factors, but just the opposite is true. The people that we're working with here at this library are very aware, very knowledgeable about these issues, and they express their concerns. And they may be, you know, sensing different factors. They may be looking and considering different issues from what other people are taking in. But they're very aware of climate change. They're very aware of rising sea levels, and it is of concern. We do hear that from our patrons.
Appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today, Matthew.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We have been hearing from people who live and work in Waikiki about their experiences with climate change and sea level rise. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Jim and Andrea Harris on Maui, station members and fans for more than 15 years, in appreciation for HPR's programming.
Think about the last time you had to have a hard conversation with someone. Did you put it off?
You do have to sort of think about, why are we avoiding these topics? And are those reasons good? Are they biased? Are they preventing us from having a deeper relationship?
Finding a way through tough discussions. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the East-West Center's Pacific Islands Report, featuring news headlines, essays, and commentary from across the Pacific Islands at pireport.org, messaging supported by the Turbin Chu Fund.
There's an effort known as RAP, or the Waikiki Resilience and Adaptation Project. It aims to begin the conversation about protecting Waikiki from erosion and flooding. And a second plan called Adapt Waikiki 2050 is being led by the city's Department of Planning and Permitting. It's a work in progress to develop a blueprint for short and long-term solutions to rising sea levels. We sat down with Ben Sullivan, the city's chief resilience officer, at a park bench near the seawall construction that's been taking place along the shoreline.
I think it's important to recognize that the ocean environment is a harsh place. So any coastal infrastructure is always going to take a lot of upkeep. Certainly, we know that there's already been about 6 inches of sea level rise since 1910, and there's, you know, we expect to get to a foot by mid-century or maybe even a little sooner. But ultimately, what's happening is, because of all of our carbon pollution, we're continuing to add more and more carbon in the atmosphere. We're increasing global temperatures, and we're increasing sea level rise by, you know, glacial melt. And so the effect of that is that we are going to be on a multi-century event of just continuing sea level rise. We have good science that tells us how much we can expect based on different trajectories for carbon emissions over the next maybe 50 or 100 years, but outside beyond that, who knows? And really, I think that the timelines that we're all familiar with and that we talk within are really a lot shorter than that, right? We think within 10, 15 years, some people will think a little longer, but it's really hard for people to wrap their head around even, say, a 2100 target, right, and a number, you know, which we know in this case, we're looking at on the outside as much as 6 feet of sea level rise in Waikiki by 2100, which is a scary thought and very, very impactful. But there's certainly a lot of things we can do between now and then to extend the life of the infrastructure that's there and to enjoy the place, adapt, and then, you know, who knows how much we can do beyond that. There's really smart people thinking about solutions, as you know, across the state.
Well, when people think of sea level rise, we think of coastal erosion. We see the sand replenishment, you know, that happens regularly in Waikiki. But there's also the hidden threat, right? The rising groundwater.
That's correct. So rising groundwater is definitely something that is more urgent than some of the other things that people are more familiar with. And that is because all of our infrastructure is below the surface of the ground. And it's very complex infrastructure. It's stuff that's really difficult to modify, change, renovate, just in any set of conditions, never mind when it's saturated by salt water. So what we're looking at is just imagine all the infrastructure required for all this density, right? Where there's sewer, there's electrical infrastructure, there's water delivery infrastructure, right? There's so much there. And likely a huge part of it is vulnerable. There's also, I didn't even mention the drainage infrastructure, right? But there is a specific set of drainage culverts that do the job of removing rainwater every time there's a big storm. And that's an essential function. But one of the things that's happening with sea level rise is that system only has a little bit of slope, and those outfalls are getting covered up by ocean water. And so you lose the ability to drain, and that becomes a real problem. So across the board, there's challenges that we're going to face. And I think the thing to think about and the thing to conceptualize is there's going to be solutions, but those solutions are all going to have a lifespan, right? So we are used to thinking we'll build something, it'll be there forever from our perspective, you know, whether it's a 50 or 100 or 200 years, like we see some of the older structures, right? How old is the hotel there? It's 100 years plus old, right? I mean,
the Royal Hawaiian.
The Royal Hawaiian, yeah. So we think of that, and we think of kind of forever. But the reality of sea level rise and climate change is that the forever question is really a tough one now. We're going to have to do some very significant adaptation to maintain a lot of what we have here. And it will look profoundly different in 50 or 100 years.
And, a lot of the buildings, hotels, they've got sump pumps. They're prone to flooding. They've got collapsing seawalls.
Yeah, I think the folks that obviously have hotels along the beach are very aware, right? Because some of them used to have a beach, as a great example. And then, the beach itself in Waikiki is really man-made and manufactured, and it's been, upkept for over a decade, as a matter of fact, 2 decades, I think, is a safe figure to use. And the reality of that is that it will take more and more intervention to try to figure out how to maintain a beach, right? Whether it to be, building groins, just like some of these that you have here, to slow down the movement of the ocean and to reduce the wave action. There's even proposals to basically create what you'd call a perched beach, right? Which is to say, like, a fully constructed element that's above the ocean by a significant elevation that allows you to still enjoy the sand, but you'd actually step down into the ocean as opposed to having this perfectly feathered surface, which we're used to in a natural beach environment.
So it's kind of a retreat.
It's a facsimile of what we have today. It's not quite the same thing, right? And that's part of the conversation. There are so many elements. I think the RAP project out of UH, which I believe you've had some discussions on.
Yeah, Waikiki RAP.
It's the Waikiki RAP project. It does a great job of just talking about things from a conceptual level and from a level of possibilities, but with the realities of sea level rise introduced. So, some of the things it talks about, you mentioned basements, right? It talks about the potential to be reusing basement spaces as stormwater catchment, because ultimately those spaces are not going to be viable for occupancy the way we conceive of it in 30 or 50 years. And so what are we going to do with it? And, one of the proposed solutions of many that they've come up with, just to help people understand and wrap their heads around it, is allowing stormwater to temporarily flow into those spaces and then pump it out after a storm, so that you're putting the water somewhere, because that's the question with regards to rainfall and sea level rise, is where does that rainfall go when you have a higher ocean? So there's just, there's so many other ways we can go about it. We're already seeing a lot of the new construction really think carefully about what they put on the ground floor and how high the ground floor is. And we've been seeing that for years already, but that's going to take continued adaptation and consideration to really establish norms. And I think one of the things that the city is going to do fairly soon, and or is going to need to do fairly soon, is really define the baseline for what the future is going to look like, right? Right now, a lot of the new development, folks are taking their own best guess at what they might do in terms of how is this building going to interface with sea level rise over time. But ultimately, giving guidance and creating like a design flood elevation and saying, hey, this is where we think how all buildings should approach sea level rise, so that we can then plan our infrastructure accordingly.
Right. We're talking the sewer lines. We're talking the water lines, fiber, those kinds of things that are vital to keep Waikiki going.
Yeah, but even the services, right? I mean, we often overlook, like, think of how much effort goes into servicing these buildings with vehicles coming in and out, right? If you have all these different elevations and, there's even talk of raising streets, what does that mean? And how does it look? And so I think there's more questions than answers today in Waikiki, but the good thing is there's really a lot of smart people studying both the science and the possibilities in terms of design. And really the two big projects that are happening, one is from the Department of Planning and Permitting with the Adapt Waikiki 2050 project. So that one's a little bit more near term, and it's very, very science-based and engineering-based. And it's, I would say, more conservative in terms of its approach and thinking about the solutions. And then you have the RAP project, the Waikiki RAP project that you mentioned, which, coming from a university, it's a little bit more free thinking and like out of the box. And those two, they're going to have to come together. Like, we're going to have to do some of the real imaginative stuff, but we have to found it in what's there, right? We're talking about billions of dollars of infrastructure that need to be improved ultimately to service what is just an incredible place, a place with such history, a place that's so important to both the economy and to people in their own lives, that we just have to make sure we can do our best, and we can do it in a way that brings everybody along. Because any huge infrastructure project, any projects, there's so many in the course of our history as a state, but they're incredibly challenging because people get excited and they get upset, and it's big change, right?
Well, Alawai Canal is a perfect example, right? That didn't exist before in old Waikiki. Now it does, and now we're grappling with ways to protect Waikiki in case it spills over.
That's right, yeah. So you're talking about the Alawai watershed and about the issues and the Army Corps of Engineers. Certainly there's been a lot of study over the years about how to approach that. Obviously there's real challenges in terms of the cost of those solutions. And so that's the kind of conversation, you know, if folks are familiar with how difficult that conversation has been, there are likely to be many more conversations we're going to have to engage in Waikiki to think about solutions for this place. And it won't just be that one. It'll be when and where do we actually consider raising the streets? How do we think about vehicle access? And it's not, you know, it's everyday access for you and me, but it's also, you know, more critically access for emergency vehicles, right, in storm situations. So after 1.5-2 feet of water on the street, you have a real problem with moving, you know, those vehicles being able to move in and out and really get people to safety, right? So in an emergency situation, somebody's hurt, they need to be evacuated. There's 2 feet or more of water to deal with. It makes it really, really difficult.
Are you concerned at all just with the change of policy with the new administration? Because your office is not that old, and climate was a big focus, and now it may be a target.
So we're talking today about climate adaptation, right? We're talking about what we're going to do to respond to the inevitable impacts of climate change. I don't think that's a target of this administration. I think that the target of this administration is the high-profile stuff that they believe was being forced on, and I'm speaking from the perspective of the administration, they believe was being forced on them by people who thought they had a better solution than everyone else, you know. So I think we can talk about things like electric vehicles. That path is going to be a lot harder to pave without federal support. I think there's other aspects of the previous administration that were really great, really, that said, hey, one of the things we need to do to address these climate challenges is we need to engage community more directly. We need to actually bring funding to communities so they can be solving these problems. I don't believe that that's something we're going to see in the new administration, and that's unfortunate because this is not something we can solve from the top. Right, it is an everybody, it's a CACO thing, right? It really needs to be everybody, all hands on deck, understanding, communicating, sharing, thinking.
We're in this together.
Yes,
we're in this together.
In this together, absolutely.
So as you take the long view, mm-hmm. for the short term, then it may be difficult for these outreach funds to continue. You know, there may be grants that the city has right now that the funding could dry up.
So I think there are definitely concerns about funding drying up in a bunch of different sectors, and I'm not going to comment on ones outside of our own. You know, we work in the climate space. We're certainly wanting to preserve those activities as much as we can, and so we're certainly talking about what does it look like to do that, and we'll determine that with the leadership of the mayor and the council, and you know, as we go forward. I think we have to just continue to find ways to engage people regardless of those funds, because ultimately people want to be a part of these solutions, right? So it's what are the means we have to help people to the table so that they can tell us what they want, what are the right solutions in their community. And as you know, on Oahu, like the rest of the state, every little community is very different, and they have very strong opinions that we have to listen to and respect in order to get anywhere, because we've all seen what happens when you come in heavy-handed and try to say, this is how we're going to solve something, and without listening and without asking and understanding. And it's just more trouble than you ever want to get into. So it's going to require those kind of processes, and it, I guess, to be determined as to what that's going to look like from the new administration. But, you know, maybe there's positives, too. Maybe there's a place for less regulation overall. Maybe some of these projects can be very much led by community, but then not held back as much by bureaucracy. So, you know, we got to work with what we have and try to make the best of it.
What do you tell people who are concerned about sea level rise and climate change, uh-huh. and may see some of the funding dry up?
Well, it's not a problem that is going to go away, and it's not a problem we're going to stop working on. Certainly, Mayor Blangiardi understands the importance of making progress on these challenges, and I know that the same viewpoint is held at the state level. And so between the local and the state, I think we can continue to make progress. And then, you know, every administration comes with a 4-year time limit. So there'll be a new one in 4 years, and perhaps the tide will turn. Perhaps also there will be other ways to kind of frame this, because it is really about language and messaging as much as it is anything else. And so perhaps we'll learn how to speak the language of the new administration in D.C. and still receive the funding needed to execute some of this work.
That was Ben Sullivan, Chief Resilience Officer for the city, talking to us about efforts by the county, state, and the University of Hawaii to find ways to adapt to climate change. Coming up, we'll be taking a closer look at the hidden threat of sea level rise to critical infrastructure.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, actor John Leguizamo tells us about his harshest critic.
And then she comes afterwards, oh, John, that was fantastic, but I didn't really like the punchline. It didn't really hit the way I thought it would hit. It didn't murder. And I was like, Mom, just be unconditionally loving for once.
I'm Peter Sagal. You will unconditionally love this week's news quiz with John Leguizamo, Mark Ronson, Billy Porter, and more. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The Galliard String Quartet and friends celebrate Beethoven with his String Quartet No. 7 and his septet March 1st at Doris Duke Theater. Chambermusichawaii.org.
First met University of Hawaii researcher Shelley Habel a few years ago. She had been flying drones for a project studying the impact of king tides. We connected with her last week as she fished out specialized equipment from the Alawai Canal to study flood inundation. She tells us that her research over the years has tracked high levels of fecal bacteria correlating to high visitor counts in Waikiki hotels, which makes you wonder how it's getting into the canal. Habel is a hydrologist and geologist with the university's Climate Resilience Collaborative. In her most recent project, she's partnering with the Honolulu Board of Water Supply to study the hidden threat of rising sea levels.
We are here in the middle of Waikiki at Centennial Park, and we're Royal Hawaiian Avenue and Seaside. So, like, who knew that we had this ground monitoring well?
So this one's right in the center of Waikiki. So this one kind of is one we rely on to tell us kind of the conditions of the water table throughout Waikiki. We have a couple of other ones, but this one is kind of special just because it's right in the center.
Okay. All right. Well, go for it.
All right. So this is a pipe that penetrates into the ground down to the water table.
How far down is it?
Okay, well, we'll check right here. I have a groundwater monitoring device. We'll just lower it down. So it'll beep once it hits the water table.
Okay, so this is a cable on a spool that you're just dropping down into this tube.
Here we go. So when it beeps, that means it's hit water. We can see that it is about 1.3 meters below the ground surface, which is about just over 4 feet.
Okay, and so what does that tell us?
So we know that by looking at these groundwater wells, we can see how the groundwater table goes up when the tide goes up. It also increases when, you know, we get a bunch of rainfall and that water percolates down into the ground. And so it tells us the dry space we have between the ground surface and water. And so it's influenced by the tide. Therefore, as sea level continues to rise, it elevates that base elevation. And so it kind of shrinks that dry space below the ground surface. And so at first, as a knee-jerk reaction, you kind of think about, like, when the water table reaches the surface, it'll cause damage, because that's when you start to see the flooding and water problems, things like that. But actually, there's this whole network of underground infrastructure that the water table reaches first.
So we're talking the sewer pipes and the water pipes and the storm drain?
Exactly. And you don't exactly see a lot of electrical wiring on telephone poles around here, right? So a lot of that is underground.
By design.
By design. And so as groundwater becomes elevated, it starts to cause underground flooding. And when you have things like metal pipes being bathed in this water, it starts to increase the rate of corrosion. And this water, it's not like pristine, like clean water that you drink, things like that.
Brackish?
It's brackish. So it's a little bit salty. And so that saltier water starts to corrode that underground infrastructure even faster.
And so what have your studies shown since you've been monitoring this?
Well, they've shown that, as expected, the groundwater is influenced by the tide and rainfall. And so we build models that kind of replicate where the water table is across our study area, which here is Waikiki. And we can use our models to apply expected increases in sea level. And so we can start to understand how deep the water table is, and we can compare that to where underground infrastructure is. And then we can start to look at where that water table starts to come up above the ground surface. And the water is known to be contaminated by things like sewage and other types of contaminants. And so as it reaches the ground surface, it produces a public health concern.
So do we have a handle as to how shallow those pipes are? How far down are they?
They can vary from, you know, several feet down to just a foot down. So it really depends.
Wow. Okay. And so is there any particular area that you can say is more at risk just because of the rising sea levels? Like what part of Waikiki? Is it more Diamond Head side or Evaside?
It's actually more Evaside. So that whole area just historically used to be fish ponds and things like that. And then that area was filled as part of development projects. But it's still naturally really low-lying. When it was filled, it wasn't filled very much. And so those are just naturally the first places that start to flood as groundwater emerges. And we're starting to actually see that over in Mapunapuna. Our models do simulate groundwater emergence in that area. And we've worked with geochemists at UH to use tracers to determine that groundwater is actually emerging.
And then we're not too far off from the Alawai Canal. What's the connection there?
Yeah, like underground, if you can imagine, like, there's a level of the Alawai, there's a level of the ocean, and it penetrates right through that ground, right through that soil. Just like if you had like a cup of soil and poured water into it, it's gonna rise, right? It's gonna, all those little pores are gonna get saturated by the water. And so it exists at a level that's basically equal or a little bit higher than the Alawai.
Is it basically saturates than the ground that we're talking about we see around the Alawai?
Right, it does.
So really then, you're monitoring it because we need to figure out what is our strategy for these underground utilities, and you know, how do we deal with this as the creep comes this way?
Exactly, and it's underground utilities and also basements throughout Waikiki.
And then are we hearing any reports from any hotels or condos along the shoreline?
Yeah, so groundwater inundation into basements in Waikiki is a widespread problem.
And how are the owners, the property owners, dealing with it?
They're dealing with it by pumping. They're dealing with it by wrapping some of their like structural beams inside the building, and they're also elevating the ground floor in some buildings that I've seen.
What else do you think would be important for listeners to know as we try and understand what's happening with rising sea levels? I mean, we see things on the shore, we see the sand, you know, erode away, we see sidewalks collapsing, and there's work to try and, you know, remedy that. But what else should we drive home to our listeners?
I think just that sea level has been rising. I think there's a misconception that sea level will rise but is not rising now. But if you look at the Honolulu tide gauge and other tide gauges around the state, there is a trend of sea level rise that's been ongoing for since records began. And in Honolulu, those records began even before World War I. So those are very long-term records.
And we've had some like sewer breaks.
That kind of breakage, it has been connected to shallow groundwater in not just here, but in various places around the world. So as that groundwater rises, it's influenced by the tide, and it can cause like soil grains to become unsettled. And so that structural support of infrastructure is kind of compromised. And so that, among other things, can cause things like water main breaks.
But that's all connected?
It can be, definitely. Mm-hmm. All of these things can exacerbate that kind of damage.
That was University of Hawaii researcher Shelley Habel, whose expertise is in geology and hydrology. We were out in the field with her as she checked in on the groundwater monitoring wells in Waikiki.
This year marks a decade since 500,000 gallons of wastewater spilled into the Alawai from flooded manholes in the Waikiki area. And remember the large spill in 2006 after a 42-inch aging sewage pipe called a force main broke? Well, Roger Babcock does. He's the city's director of environmental services. In that case, 48 million gallons of raw sewage was diverted into the canal. That event and others triggered a federal consent decree and is in part why the city is proposing hikes in our sewer fees to modernize our system.
I do remember the force main break where had to pump into Alawai Canal in order to prevent backups throughout, you know, all the residents and hotels in Waikiki, right? So that was the only way to keep stuff flowing.
Right. And all that is tied to the fact that we have to raise the fees to upgrade and modernize our sewage treatment facility, our systems.
Yeah, exactly. There are multiple threats, of course, associated with sea level rise. One is coastal erosion, right? So the shoreline is going to change, right? Or there's at least a lot of pressure for it to change. So that's a problem for all the infrastructure, of course, right along the coast. And we do have some, right? We have some sewers. Our pump stations are mostly back a little ways. There would have to be really a lot of erosion before it affected our pump stations, which are, of course, major infrastructure. But the other threats are flooding associated with, you know, heavy rains and things like that, a storm surge of the ocean levels rising up with that, and then, of course, sea level rise, right? So storm surge could be associated with a hurricane too, right? So those are the major threats to our infrastructure, you know, all along the coast. And then as sea levels rise, then there's groundwater inundation, right? So the groundwater levels is going to rise with the sea level rise, right? So if sea level rises up 3 feet, then the groundwater becomes 3 feet closer to the ground, or 6 feet. It becomes then, you know, almost right at the surface. So there's groundwater appearing above ground. And so that's in the very long term, right? And we've seen those maps that Chip Fletcher folks put out, kind of showing this inundation associated with those different threats. And under various scenarios, then wastewater infrastructure is impacted. In Waikiki, there are gravity sewers throughout, meaning the drains drain into pipes that have to flow downhill on a slope until they get to a pump station. And there are three pump stations in Waikiki, the public baths pump station, which is right next to the aquarium. There's the beach walk pump station, which is a little more kind of hidden. It's in the middle of Waikiki. And then there's a pump station out at Fort DeRussy. So those are the ones in Waikiki that we have to make sure remain functional. So water accumulates there, you know, wastewater that's been flowing through the gravity sewers throughout the Waikiki, and they flow there, and then they're pumped in pipes, essentially out of Waikiki, and then on their way over to Sand Island Wastewater Treatment Plant. And, you know, as sea level rise sometime in the future reaches 1.1 or 3.2 or even 6 feet, then eventually, you know, the infrastructure is impacted. It's actually impacted sooner currently in 100-year flood and hurricane-type scenarios where potentially those pump stations could have problems and be perhaps partially inundated. But in preparation for that, we can do certain kind of small projects to be ready for those. It's only in the more distant future where you have a combination of sea level rise and on top of that, a flood or a hurricane where we need to do more work.
What kind of shape are our sewer pipes in? How confident do you feel that we don't have leaks in there that are contributing to the degraded waters, let's say, in the Alawai?
There's all different sizes of sewer pipes. So most of the sewer pipes are kind of small, about 6 inches in diameter. And then there are much bigger pipes, our sewer mains, which could be 24 inches or even bigger. And so most of the focus on rehabilitating or lining where we seal the pipes up is done in our larger pipes because we sort of get more bang for the buck with those. And doing all of the small 6-inch pipes is very challenging. There's just a lot of them, hundreds of miles. So with the way it works, though, with sewer pipes is that it's an open system. So you could think of it like as an open channel or a river, and, you know, it's connected to the air, so it's not under pressure. It's open. So what that means is water surrounding the pipes wants to flow into the pipe. There's no pressure for water to flow out because there's water outside already, and so it can't flow sort of against a pressure normally. So what we see is we have inflow as our problem as opposed to outflow. And so at the Sand Island Treatment Plant, about 30% of the wastewater is groundwater, you know, that's inflowed into our system. And a lot of that is seawater from coastal areas. The wastewater at Sand Island is quite salty coming in, and that's because of it sort of acts as kind of a French drain to take in a lot of groundwater.
Well, what about the corrosion from the brackish water and the seawater?
So in terms of the sewer system, there's probably some cast iron pipe in different places. I don't necessarily think in Waikiki and some of their older neighborhoods in downtown Honolulu, perhaps, but most of the pipe is not corrodible. Some of it would be very old clay pipe, and most of it would be concrete. And there is some corrosion, but generally it's not because of the seawater. It would be because of sulfur. Hydrogen sulfide can cause corrosion. So corrosion is not really a big problem in the Waikiki area.
So what are the other hidden threats that may not be visible to people?
I would say that, you know, the sea level rise is a sort of an insidious sort of hidden thing that's happening, that's slow, right? It's on a very slow pace, and so it's occurring. And we know it's occurring, and we see it. And we know that will lead to more infiltration. And we've accounted for that in our modeling and our sizing of the treatment plants and pump stations. We mitigate some of that by doing lining, but it's not really possible to eliminate. The bigger challenge, I think, is going to be what's going to happen to Waikiki in general, how it's going to adapt to sea level rise and eventually, you know, sort of daily flooding. Is everything going to be raised up, or roads and sidewalks and buildings, first floor disappears and second floor becomes the first floor, or what's going to happen there? And depending on that overall plan, that will also be a factor in how the various utilities adapt. So we can raise sewers, but only if streets are raised. And the same thing would be true with drainage and with drinking water and with electrical systems and all that stuff too. So there's, you know, some overall planning efforts, right? The Waikiki 2050 and stuff like that are looking at that. And those are, you know, those are multi-agency efforts. And so we're all trying to figure out what does that future look like.
What will Waikiki's future look like? We've been hearing from Roger Babcock, director of the City Environmental Services Department. We've been taking a closer look at sea level rise, eating away at our beaches and the area's underground utilities, which include vital sewer and water lines. We hope you enjoyed taking a deep dive into this topic as we explore climate change on the edge of Waikiki. We do plan to return in the months to come, so stay tuned as we explore our vulnerabilities and efforts to adapt to rising sea levels. That's it for this Aloha Friday. We would like to thank the Library for the Blind and Print Disabled here in Waikiki for hosting us this morning. Coming up next week, we get the buzz around a new bee species discovered recently. Who knew there were new critters waiting to be discovered? We welcome feedback. Call 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and today, Mark Liddell. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.